I don't think I started it in a traditional fashion, right? Like, I think most traditional entrepreneurs, you have an idea and you start, right? Or you fall into a vertical that, hey, you happen to work in the space, you found something interesting and you started, right? I kind of reverse engineered it. I was like, hey, I have this very vague, wide goal of, you know, poverty alleviation through like social enterprise. But, you know, I don't know how, where, when to start, what vertical to focus on. So, yeah, so I kind of, I almost think Ashaya was like 4 years in the making, right? So ever since I quit, I spent the first 2 or 3 years researching impact and kind of really learning what it means to make impact. And not just by books, right? By experiencing and by living in developing countries, working with entrepreneurs who are working on real problems and seeing the day to day. And like nothing beats that education, right? Hi, my name is Anish Malpani and this is Climate Tech Talks.
Welcome everyone. Today we have a really exciting conversation with Anish Malpani. He brings over 8 years of experience in finance, strategy, operations, impact and data across the 3 continents. He's helped startups in Guatemala, Kenya, Africa, and now he's developing Ashaya. Ashaya is a social enterprise that aims to increase the value of waste through technological and scientific innovations. They want to help waste pickers in India. There are about 1.5 million waste pickers who live poor lives. They are informally employed, no contract, no PPE, and their life expectancy is 39 years versus the 69 years of average in India. They are also trying to develop chemical and mechanical upcycling processes for impossible to recycle plastic waste. Welcome, Anish. I'm very happy to have you here. Thank you for your time. It's an honor, actually, to be launching the India series with you. Anish is an entrepreneur from Ashaya. Ashaya, it's a waste company. They are trying to recycle waste. It's very difficult to recycle plastic and then turn it into a profitable asset. So welcome, Anish. How are you?
Good, man. Thanks for having me, Daniel. I'm excited to have this conversation with you.
Great. Why don't we kick it from the beginning? And would you tell us who are you and where do you come from?
So I was born in India. I was here till I was 9 years old. And then my parents moved to Dubai. And that's where I spent my formative years. And then it was very normal for kids to go abroad to study. So I went to the US. I studied my undergrad in Texas. And I worked in New York. In the whole corporate rat race, and then kind of realized that I don't want to spend the rest of my life making rich people richer. So I quit to kind of pursue purpose. And then I was very lucky to spend some time in Guatemala where I worked with local entrepreneurs. And then I spent some time in Nairobi where I also worked with some local entrepreneurs. And then I came to India to kind of start something, to start a social enterprise focused on poverty. And I came across the waste management space. And it really attracted me for two reasons. One is waste in India attracts. So waste in India is essentially run by waste pickers who live extremely poor lives on many different levels, right? Not only do they not earn a lot of money, but they also have like a lower life expectancy. Like it can be as low as 39 years of age versus 69 for both you and me. They also like normally low caste migrant workers. It's a generational occupation. So once you're born a waste picker, you are a waste picker, and they don't really have the PPE and stuff to work. So it's not a fun life to lead, I don't think. So so that was something, and my burning is around poverty. So that was something that was very intriguing. At the same time, 81% of the waste in India is untreated, right? And half of it ends up in landfills. So I felt like there's like a gold mine, or there's untapped value in this. So how could you increase the value of waste and use that to empower waste pickers? That's what, you know, got me to starting Ashaya. And also, like, obviously, waste is closely connected with climate change and with the other environmental aspects. So like the complexity of this problem is something that is really interesting. And we at Ashaya are hitting it not just unidimensionally. We're not focused on one thing. We're focused on the entire gamut, on the complexity of the waste problem, which is social, environmental, economical, and how to solve that at a decentralized, inclusive, cutting edge level. So yeah, that's me in a long story long.
I'm curious, when did you realize you wanted to work to develop a social impactful entrepreneurship. It was back in the days in the US, or did you move to India already knowing what you wanted to do?
So that's a good question. So social enterprise, I think, was introduced to me as a concept by my sister. She's like, hey, have you heard of this concept of social enterprise? Read this book by Jacqueline Novogratz called The Blue Sweater. And this was right when I was like depressed in New York, like wanted to quit, not want to make people richer. And that really cemented an idea that had been like sitting dormant in my head for a while about social entrepreneurship. When I was 19, I met a social entrepreneur in India who was doing some really good work with ambulances and medical care. But then I kind of like, no, I want to kind of, you know, work in sports, and I want to go and I want to, you know, work in finance and make money and all that. So I kind of forgot about it. But then when I was all down and depressed, when I was in New York, I was making good money. I was like at a point where I thought that, you know, this was it. This was all that I wanted. And after having all that I wanted, I was like really depressed. I was like, this doesn't make any sense.
You're empty.
How can I? Yeah, I was empty. That's a good way of putting it. So I was like, okay, let me look at. My sister sent me this book, The Blue Sweater by Jacqueline Novogratz. Highly recommend it. And that was the tipping point. It kind of exposed me to the idea of entrepreneurship and social entrepreneurship specifically. And it clicked because I always believed in entrepreneurship and enterprise. I've always found that to be interesting. And then to do enterprise for purpose was just like the immediate click, right? I was like, okay, this is it. This is what I want to do. I want to go to India, work on poverty, which is the cause that I care about, through social enterprise, which is the tool I can use, right? And I think that really exposed me to the idea. But again, when I heard about it at an early stage through the book and through the, I knew nothing about it. So I wanted to really study it and understand it at a deeper level. And I think that's what led me to Guatemala and Nairobi and eventually to India.
And then you started Ashaya by yourself
other founders? So I think it's a really good question, because I don't think I started it in a traditional fashion, right? Like, I think most traditional entrepreneurs, you have an idea and you start, right? Or you fall into a vertical that, hey, you know, you happen to work in the space, you found something interesting and you started, right? I kind of reverse engineered it. I was like, hey, I have this very vague, wide goal of, you know, poverty alleviation through like social enterprise. But, you know, I don't know how, where, when to start, what vertical to focus on. So, yeah, so I kind of, Ashaya was like 4 years in the making, right? So ever since I quit, I spent the first 2 or 3 years researching impact and kind of really learning what it means to make impact. And not just by books, right? By experiencing and by living in developing countries, working with entrepreneurs who are working on real problems and seeing the day-to-day. And like, nothing beats that education, right? When you're like, you're not an entrepreneur, but you're working very closely to entrepreneurs, learning from their mistakes, learning from things that they're doing very well. And so when I came to India, I felt like I was very prepared to start a social enterprise. But then I was like, it's been like about more than a year and a half since I've been back in India. But the first year in India, I was like, no, I haven't lived in India for over 20 years. I can't pretend I understand India, even though I'm Indian. So I spent like the first year like really learning about India, got exposed to the waste management space, got interested in what that was doing. And then again, and I didn't just start. I went and I found an organization that is doing amazing work in Aurangabad. They call CAPE. And I offered my time there. I'm like, hey, listen, I can help you with stuff for free if you just give me exposure to this space. And it was a 3-week project, right, that I was with them. And now I'm a part of the organization. I'm on their board, right? And I work with them closely. And I learned a lot. They found value in what I was doing. I found value in what they were doing. But then I was like, after doing all of that, I was like, okay, I know what I need to do and where I need to start. I researched the waste space a lot, right? And I was like, okay, the intervention needs to be in the tech, right? There's not enough tech working on things that are really hard to recycle. Like, India is a very interesting example, right? So 60% of plastic in India is recycled. That's much higher than the global average of 9%, right? Like, when it comes to PET bottles, those Bisleri bottles, 80 to 90% of bottles are recycled, right? So if I started a PET bottle recycling company, right, I wouldn't be really impacting the problem as much, because already 90% is taken care of. It's like right pocket, left pocket, right? So I'm like, if I really want to make a dent in this space, you got to work on stuff that's the 40% is ending up in the landfill, right? That's why we chose the kind of waste we're choosing. We chose MLP, which is multi-layered packaging, specifically metallized MLP, which is like really hard to recycle because there's an inner aluminum layer, 3 or 4 layers of plastic outside, adhesives, it's a mess. We chose colored PET bottles, which are, you know, unlike transparent PET bottles, colored PET bottles are not recycled. and polycotton textile waste, which is also, you know, fast fashion is a thing. So that's the stuff we're working on. And that's what led me to do Ashaya. Again, long answer long.
And then what about your other co-founders?
Yeah, I figured out the intervention needed to be on the tech, right?
Yeah.
Like, so I'm like, okay, I'm not a chemist. I don't understand chemistry. I'm not going to learn chemistry. And all I'd learned about social enterprise and social impact, I realized that you don't want to try to do things. Don't set yourself up for failure, right? So if I try to become a chemist, I'd be setting myself up for failure, right? Because like, you can't buy years and years of experience yourself. You have to kind of invest and find the right partner. So I went to LinkedIn, what I did was I had a vision, I had a mission, I'd done all this research, right? So I'm like, hey, why not just share this with the world and see who's interested in joining the course, right? I kind of put out I made a website, I kind of put out like my vision and mission, put out like an application form, put out like all the uncertainties and the question marks that I had to solve, I knew what I was looking for. I was looking for a chief scientist, a co-founding chief scientist, and put out there. And then, so that's like the beautiful story, right? But then there is a twist to that, right? So the twist was that I knew that just looking for a co-founder is very hard. Like, it's who's going to take the risk of like quitting their jobs, working full time? Like, that's a lot of work.
Yeah, an unknown guy or something.
Yeah, and everyone's like, everyone has priorities, and everyone has, people have family, people need money. So I'm like, I have capital. Like, I have, like, I'm $200,000 that I'm investing in this organization, right? And money, $200,000 goes a lot further in India than it does in other parts of in the US or the UK, right? I'm like, I have this money, right? Like, why don't I de-risk it for somebody who wants to be a co-founder, right? So why don't I pay them some sort of a salary so that they're not taking as big a risk, right? I'm still a risk because this could fail, right? I keep telling my co-founder now that, dude, like, this is, this is still high risk, but at least it's deal. I mean, he has a wife, he has a kid, he has a second kid coming. So it's much harder for him to take risks. But if I hadn't done that, my pool of potential co-founders would have been severely smaller, right? So it was a risk that I was taking, but I found like the most amazing co-founder. He has a PhD in chemistry. He's geeks out about the science. You know, I'm more focused on the business, like outside of the things. So it's been a really good combination. And at the same time, like, I've de-risked it for him. So it's not like just like, you know, I've de-risked it for him, which makes it very interesting because that's not what people normally do. But that's my unfair advantage, right? I have some capital. You know, most entrepreneurs don't start off with capital, right? So people who have entrepreneurs don't take really, really difficult risks. I mean, they do, but like the stuff we're working on, nobody would work on because there's like no incentive. Like, there's the probability of our success, the probability of making money is so low that it's a very high risk play. And having the capital, the risk that we took, the company that I started had to be high risk because I had the luxury of risk-free capital, right? It had to be something that a high probability of failure, because then I wouldn't be doing justice to the money that I had.
Yeah, that's the only way to make a meaningful impact, right? I mean, you have to take the leap of faith at any point in time, right?
Yeah.
So waste is a huge problem everywhere, right? But I'm aware that waste management is also a big problem in India, even though 60% of plastic get recycled, right? So, as you mentioned before about waste pickers, how will you help them? Because I'm aware that they don't work for a particular company or something like that, right? They are like self-employed, sort of.
Right.
How will you impact them?
That's a really good question. Something, you know, I struggle with a lot, and I'd be lying if I told you I have the answer, right? And I think and that's the thing, like, I don't want to rush to an answer for that question, right? I want to work with the waste pickers to be like, hey, what's best for you? What is the right answer?
What do they need?
What do you guys need? Because again, our perspective is that we don't want to help 100,000 waste pickers by giving them 10% extra income, right? That is not going to solve the problem. We rather help 100 waste pickers and go much deeper and get them permanently out of this poverty so that they don't have to ever worry about, you know, doing this, right? And obviously, then we can scale the depth of the impact. So the depth matters more to us than just pure numbers, right? But to do that, like, it's impossible to tell, to be like, I mean, I'm not a waste picker. I don't know what it feels like to be a waste picker. We obviously work with waste pickers and we want to, you know, we talk to them, but that's not enough, right? Plus, you gotta have leverage, right? We don't like, so our play right now is that let's extract as much margin as we can from the waste, right? Because once you have margin, you can use to impact waste pickers in a way that would benefit them. to answer your question more directly, in the short term, we're going to ethically incorporate them into the supply chain, which means that pay them a premium, make sure we're not displacing them, make sure we're not trampling them, right? Make sure we're not doing any harm to them. That's the first step in the short run, right? In the long run, we want to work with them very closely to be like, hey, what do we need to do? We need to invest in the education of your children, right? Do we need to upskill you into a different profession? If we upskill you in a different profession, do other waste pickers take your place? Then is that just like, are we actually solving the waste picking problem? It's really complex. And that's, last thing I'll say is that that's why we chose Pune as a starting point. So Pune has this amazing organization called Swachh, Swachh Cooperative, that is basically a waste picker collective that organizes about 3,500 waste pickers here in Pune. And they've existed for 20 years, right? So they're doing amazing work with waste pickers. And we're working directly with them. Now listen, why, we're not going to recreate the wheel. Let's work with you. Let's see how we incorporate waste pickers in a way that we're not. So the first pilot we're going to design with them, right? Because hey, how do we make sure we pay them the right, at least in the beginning, let's pay the right prices so that they feel valued for the work that they're doing, right? And then if we get success, if we extract the margin, then hopefully we're in a position of leverage where we can really do, you know, meaningfully impact them, right? So we're not in a rush, which sounds bad because, you know, you should be in a rush to solve these problems, but we want to get it right. You know, people have rushed solutions in the past and we're not, you know, we want to get it right.
Yeah, and they didn't work before, right?
Not necessarily. I mean, it works a little bit. It always works a little bit, right? You do a little bit of good, but sometimes it's worse, right? Sometimes, you know, you hear stories about waste pickers, people want to help them and they try to help them, but it ends up not working out. Like one interesting example that I've heard is that, you know, somebody I was speaking to, she, you know, cares about the waste pickers. We're based in Delhi. She found some waste pickers in her neighbor and gave them all PPE, right? Bought them gloves and bought them like shoes. Like, you know, like don't cut your hands through the glass. Like, you know, use masks, use, have some hygiene. And then she gave it to them and she came back like a week or 2 weeks later. And none of them were using the PPE she had given them. They've sold it off, right? So she was all distraught. She was like, oh, these people don't want to help. I mean, like, no, it's complex. It's not like they don't want to help themselves. There's just different priorities. They probably thought it was more better for them to sell it. But you solving the problem isn't like a paternal thing. You can't be like, I know what the answer is. Like, I don't think that's the answer, right? Like, you have to work closely with the target beneficiary. And that's something you learn when you work with, when you go, you know, work in developing countries with social enterprises, with, you know, with nonprofits on the ground level, you learn this. And they learn the hard way, but like, I don't have to learn the hard way. You don't have to make a mistake always to learn, right? You can learn from other people's mistakes also, right? So that's how we'd be approaching the waste picker dynamic. And last thing I'll say, about this is that I struggle with this because, you know, we are not going to be impacting waste pickers in the short term significantly, right? So my burning is around that. So I have to kind of be patient and be like, hey, can we get the tech right to eventually be in a position to impact them? So that's the truth.
That's the right approach, to be honest. I mean, you don't need to rush to be rushing that. I mean, even like that example, like the using the PPE, even in the oil and gas industry where you have like all these standard security healthy measurements, people don't use it. I mean, you will even have to develop like a culture of using your PPE, be aware of that you actually need them to be protected, you don't cut a finger or whatever. So yeah, it's a slow process. And it might be even generational, you know, it might be even that you have to train this generation to, so they share it with the next one. So
it might be a long call. Exactly. We don't want to disqualify any solutions, right? And it might be multiple solutions and different solutions for different people in different states, different countries, different cities. Like,
sure, that's right.
So it's really it's complex. And there's a beauty in the complexity, I think.
Yeah, sure. I agree. And let's move a bit towards the technical side of things. So you are like in an experimental phase, right? You are still trying, testing how to recycle all those three kind of plastic. Is that right?
So we're working with, the first thing we started off with was MLP, which is multi-layered packaging. Think chips packets that you eat from, and especially metallized ones. And we're like, this is the biggest problem, so let's try it. And then my genius co-founder, like in the first experiment we did, we got rid of the metal and we delaminated the MLP. And we're like, hey, this is too easy. Like, this is too easy. We've done something wrong. So we're like, no, this is a mistake or something. Repeat it. And it worked again. And then we're like, no, it's too good to be true. So when we spoke to our advisor, who is like more of an expert in this space, you know, he's worked in sustainability for a while. And he was like, dude, this is amazing. This is amazing. I'm like, yes, are we like missing anything? No. This is so simple, but makes sense. And, you know, why didn't I think of this? Why isn't it? So that was really exciting. That was a good way to get started. It gave us the momentum that we needed. And our tech has evolved from that simple experiment to something a lot more complex. And even today, we had a little bit of an earthquake. We're like, oh, okay, this is not working like we planned it to be. Like, we just, you know, pivot a little bit. So that was the first thing we worked on. Then, you know, we're like, hey, let's try polycotton textile waste as well, because that's, you know, that's exciting. And again, you know, my co-founder cracked that. We were able to separate the polyester and the cotton into polycotton. We were able to separate polycotton. So into polyester and cotton, right? So because 60% of all clothing material is made up of plastic. And clothing material is one of the biggest contributors of microplastics, which end up in the ocean, which end up in fish, which end up in us, right? It's one of the biggest issues. And you can't really recycle that very quickly because it's so small. They're less than 5 millimeters, like really, really small. Some of them are even like the really ones smaller than 5, the ones in nanometers, and you can't even see with your eyes, right, sometimes. So like, let's work on polycotton as well. And again, we were able to separate into polyester and cotton. So I was like, oh, this is great. And then one of our other advisors recently told us that, have you thought about colored PET bottles? I'm like, why? Because they're like, yeah, colored PET bottles are a big issue and nobody can recycle them. And so again, we had similar tech. We're like, let's try our tech on this. And it worked. We decolorized colored PET bottles as well. So we're like, oh, we have these three really hard to recycle plastic waste. MLP is a composite of metal and adhesives and many types of plastics. And polycotton is also a composite. Colored PET bottles has toxins and colors in it. But we were like, we have similar tech. So we could throw all of these into one bucket and recycle all of them using one process. So individually, our processes are really expensive. But if you kind of throw these all into one bucket, we might have the best chance of being economically viable. And what's really interesting, and this is something you only find out later, is that when you work with like this really hard to recycle plastic waste, right? The simple plastic waste is super simple. You're like, oh, PET bottles, transparent PET bottles, easy, right? HDP bottles are easy, right? Just throw it into the pot, it works. So that's where it gets really exciting. What we're excited about is that. So there's, you know, when you look at the, you probably have seen on, you know, at Terra.do, or like, you know, there's 7 types of plastic waste. They're the number 1, number 2, number 3, number 4, number 5, number 6, number 7. Number 7 is a catch-all for like all other plastic waste. But we can now throw 5 out of the 7 numbers into the same pot, right? And it'll be recycled. So we don't have to go through massive amounts of pre-sorting or pre-segregation, right? That saves you a lot of costs. So anyway, that's what we're excited about. So that's the exciting thing. The non-exciting thing, or the unexciting thing about this, is that we're very much at the lab scale, right? We're right now at the 10 gram, about to migrate to 100 grams, right? We hope to go to 1 kilogram very soon. So these are all very small things. These are very small amounts. When you scale to bigger amounts, it's obviously more complex. So we're working on, you know, and we don't even know if it's going to be economically viable. So as exciting as this is just step one, right? So what we do in this first step, since we're talking getting technical, in this first step, we throw everything into the pot. We break these polymers or these plastics into their building blocks or constituent layers, right? So what we're doing is what we get out of this pot are a bunch of building blocks, right? And a bunch of components. So that's not enough. Just selling that is not going to make us economically viable. There's not that much value in the market for just the building
blocks. Like for selling the raw materials.
Yeah,
mean?
Like just the,
okay.
Like for instance, for like we get, for one of the plastics, PET, we get its monomer. So polymers are, you know, complex big molecules. Monomer is the building block of the polymer, right? So we're getting the monomer of one of the plastics, right? So that monomer is valuable, but it's not that valuable in the market. So we can't be economically viable just selling the monomer. So we're working right now on step two, which is upcycling these building blocks, these monomers, into high quality material, right? So this is the premium material that we want. That we'll hopefully, we're looking to convert this a premium product into 3D printing filament. Because 3D printing filament gives you nimbleness, right? And plus, if you can get good 3D printing filament, that's a really good material. Because 3D printing, you know, requires a very specific parameters and specific properties to be able to be printable. So we're aiming for that. We think we can get, you know, so what we're doing with the monomers, we're repolymerizing it back into virgin PET, and we're going to make it into filament. And this would be a true infinite loop, right? So you'd be getting 100% virgin plastic from 100% recycled feedstock, right? So it's 100% recycled, get 100% virgin. So you get the best properties of virgin plastic, they're still recycled, right? So that's what we're really excited about. That's a premium product. But there's another, the second part of the remaining part, the two other parts to this pot, right? There's a cellulose, there's a biological pot, and then there's this polyolefins mix, right? So we're trying to get materials from those as well, right? They'll be slightly less premium than our premium material. So we're looking for up to 2 to 3 different materials that we get from this pot. The first is going to be the most premium, hopefully virgin PET. The second one will be semi-premium. And the third one, hopefully, will also be like somewhere between semi-premium. So we want to do better than all our, you know, all the other solutions that are out there. So, you know, we really kind of give it a, you know, because one of the biggest demands from people who buy recycled material is that they want high quality recycled material. It's really hard to guarantee high quality recycled material, and we want to try and do that.
That sounds great. What would you say is your main bottleneck right now? Is it scalability?
Yeah, I mean, so exactly. When I talk about it, I get excited, and you know, we believe we can do this, and you know, we can crack it. But the truth is, like, this is pretty, it's pretty deep, the tech. Like, you know, we've gotten to the point where even papers are like, yeah, we don't know, you know, stuff that is not like, this is pretty, a little bit uncharted territory for good reasons, right? And for the right reasons. At the same time, we don't know how economically viable this is going to be, right? We don't know if it's actually going to be viable. And what people say is that you want the tech to be viable at the raw material level, because we don't think that's possible. So we're cheating a little bit in the sense that we want to go one step higher up the supply chain. So look, pretty much looking for vertical integration, right? Instead of selling the raw material, we sell a product like a filament, or even, I mean, we're also thinking of like customized 3D printed products, like toys that we can sell with like your children's name on it, right? Like, so customized toys. So, because the further up the supply chain we go, the more margin we'll be able to extract, but the more complex it gets, right? And the harder it gets, right? So this is still, like, I keep telling the team that, you know, like, listen, this is exciting. We have a path, you know, we're lucky to have capital. But this is still really hard. Like, it's still, this is still a very low probability of success. So the hedge to that is that, you know, we can always, so what we're trying to build at Ashaya is an anti-fragile organization, right? Which means that we're not so, you know, we're not like double downing on just one kind of tech and hoping and praying to God that works. Like, if this doesn't work, we can scale back and do something slightly simpler that's still better than the alternatives. That will be viable, right? So we don't think that if this doesn't succeed, it all fails, right? We want to kind of find the right balance of something that is breakthrough but realistic in the short term, versus like, okay, too idealistic, you know, where you're going to take 10 years of research. We don't have 10 years of time, right? We're not going to do this for 10 years. Or, okay, it's too simple. Like, everyone's already doing this and it's not necessarily any better for the environment. It's slightly less worse or delaying the inevitable. So you want to find the right sweet spot there, right? And it's hard. And so the bottleneck is, are we going to be financially viable, right? Is this going to, when we start, as we start scaling, is it going to be, as you said, is it going to be scalable? Is it going to be, you know, how dangerous are we working with? We're not working with that many dangerous chemicals, but like, yeah, it's not like, you know, we don't know what the roadblocks are going to be. Hopefully a product is, you know, still safe. Like, all these things, you know, hopefully we're not creating something new that's worse for the environment. So all those things keep me up at night, but one thing for sure is that, like, yeah, we're definitely going to try and not give up on it.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. How do you picture your Ashaya roadmap in the near future? What do you already have something fixed? Like, I don't know, in 1 year we will be commercially available, or what's your
roadmap? Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah. As an early stage deep tech startup, it's very hard to plan because everything changes. Like, your things change.
How do you do that? Yeah. How do you put your mindset to
so
that?
So the way we look at it is that we have two benchmarks. I mean, sorry, two goals. Two time frames, right? There's a short time frame and the really, really long time frame, right? The really, really long time frame is our utopia. It's something that we aim towards, our 5, 10, 15, 20-year goal, right? Which is utopic, right? So for that, we believe that's a decentralized solution where, you know, you have these material recycling recovery centers at the sub-district level in all sub-districts in India that process all types of solid waste, not just plastic, but all kinds of solid waste, that incorporate the waste pickers, empower them, look out for their well-being. There are many manufacturing units that, you know, that generate revenue that can keep the material recovery center sustainable. These centers are also regenerative so that, you know, why should it be that only waste pickers or lower caste or like lower income people work there? Why can't everybody work there? Why can't you and I work in these centers? Why can't they be creative hubs, you know, innovating with new materials? So that's one. So that's, you know, and then these material cradles would be supported by research cradles or R&D labs that, you know, innovate on really hard tech, and then like a hub and spoke model, distribute that across. And, you know, we don't want to expect to do this ourselves. We work with the government, work with other nonprofits, other for-profits, you know. Well, so that's the utopia. That's what we're aiming towards. And we want to be very careful that that guides our overall decision-making, right? Because it's very simple to be like, oh, great tech. Let's just build a massive factory that, you know, does 10,000 tons, you know, a month. But I don't think that's the answer. The answer is decentralized at a medium scale, and we've got to make it viable at that point. Right? So that's the long-term goal. And the short-term, which is more realistic, this first 2 years of the gestation period is extremely important for an entrepreneur. So we have a two-year plan, right, that we anchor ourselves to. Our first benchmark is December 31st of this year, where we want to get our first material in our hand. We don't even have that material, the step two yet, right? The high quality material. We're waiting on the machine that has taken 3 months for them to customize and make for us, which is going to come this month. It's a big extruder that we've ordered. So that is a big important machine for us to like kind of, you know, move to the next step. So by December, we think we can get these, at least a prototype of a material, of two materials, right? The premium material and the semi-premium material. That's our first goal. Then next year, we want to run two or three pilots that do the whole soup to nuts process, right? Getting the waste to producing the final product, right? And experiment with like, are we selling filament? Are we selling final products? Are we selling raw materials? Experiment with that. So at the end of next year, we want to have enough of a proof of concept to be like, hey, listen, we've taken this impossible, shitty waste and made it into high quality material, right? And we've only done this at the 1 kilo scale, which is not very big. So we do 1 kilo a day, which is not big, but it's hard, right? And it's enough to kind of get people to think, okay, these guys have something. Right? Because 10 grams is too small and 100 kilograms, we would be, it's too expensive. I don't think it's worth the time, right? So that's our plan. And then we go to impact investors. Like, listen, we figured this out from a tech perspective, right? We think it could really work. And when you add the easy plastic and the easy waste to this, it becomes even more interesting. So we're going to want to raise a round, hopefully a big round, because I'm already investing a decent chunk of my money into this. So I hope I raise a round that can hopefully help us build our first two material cradles that I mentioned, right? Just the infancy. And we need to be two, not one, because we want to test synergies, right? Because we want them, both these material cradles, to work together with R&D lab that we're building here, right? So we want to raise money for that. And hopefully in 2 years, we have a convincing argument that we, you know, we've committed our time, money, capital, brains into this. You know, would you want to join along? Like, you know, we don't know. I think that'll be the true test. You know, and then I guess we get a chance to reevaluate, are we in the right direction or not? But the way things are going, man, I'm not giving up on this. My co-founder says in Hindi, "Main chhodne nahi wala," which means that I'm not going to leave this. So we're really motivated towards this, right? But I don't know. Maybe it's naive optimism. I don't know. But, you know, I wouldn't be wanting to do anything else. So I'm very content.
It's exciting. And it sounds like a plan, you know, and it's what we need. We need optimism around. Solving climate change in overall, it's a really hard task. And we need people like you and your co-founder doing this kind of trying to break in through, you know?
I mean, yeah, true. And the last thing, we haven't even addressed the whole like climate change aspect of the waste, right? And how waste contributes to that. And I think that's what it's such a complex problem and it's so interconnected. And I don't think enough people are looking at it holistically, right? I think more people are getting to that point where they are looking at it more holistically, which is nice. But you know, it's because it's really hard. It's not because nobody wants to. It's just really because when I talk to people in the waste management space and I talk to them about my utopia or our utopia at Ashaya, they all nod. They're like, yes, do you know this makes sense? And then they're like, good luck. This is like it's hard. So anyway, let's see what happens.
Yeah, let's recap. What would be your advice for someone that would want to go down this road, going to entrepreneurship and social impact?
So my take on it is that, like, the numbers say that 90% of all startups fail, right? And then for social impact startups, social enterprises, the number is even worse, because not only do you have to be financially viable and have a business model that works, you have to also be impact centric. And if anything, impact needs to come first. So the chances of you succeeding are much lower, right? And so when people look at these numbers of 90%, 95%, people are like, oh my God, like, you know, it's so crazy, these entrepreneurs. But the way I look at it is that, why do we have those numbers? Those numbers suck. Why do 90% of entrepreneurs fail? Like, why are we encouraging entrepreneurship, right? So let's take a step back and think, like, you know, can we bring that number down? So when I speak to people that are interested in entrepreneurship, my first thing is that, listen, there are enough entrepreneurs out there, which sounds bad, but there are entrepreneurs out there doing cool things, right? Go join them first. Learn as much as you can from people that you are inspired by, or people that have a similar vision to you. Be willing to compromise a little bit and be a little patient. Like, the secret of life is delayed gratification, right? So how do you take calculated risks that focus on delayed gratification? So kind of have the patience of really looking and learning from other entrepreneurs. I mean, I think I learned more from other entrepreneurs' mistakes, you know, than anything, right? And that's really powerful. And then you'll know when you're ready to be an entrepreneur, right? You'll know that, okay, I am ready. I want to do something that nobody else is doing. I've learned enough. I'm ready for this. And I think that's the right time to be an entrepreneur, because we absolutely need more entrepreneurs, but we need absolutely more good entrepreneurs that have a higher chance of success, not somebody who's going to make the numbers look even worse, right? So that's my take on impact. And honestly, for social enterprise, that's the future. So if you're considering entrepreneurship, even in general, has to be purpose-centric, or I think that's what the world's going to move towards. It's already moving towards, and you know, I think that's the future. So that's my take on it. And I don't want to sound like a negative Nancy, but like, I think that's, it's important to be like holistic about this.
Yeah, you don't. It's really, actually really inspiring. And thank you for those words. It's been amazing, Anish. Thank you for your time and your kind words. We look forward to see what Ashaya is going to do in the next future.
Thanks, Daniel. Thanks for listening and giving me a platform.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
The views expressed in this podcast are my own and do not reflect the opinion of my current employer, TES. If you like this episode, please subscribe and give us a like. It really is important for us. This episode was produced by Julio César Fernández.